Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Mark Gross Podcast. I've always been really curious about communicating beyond spoken language. And of course, that really comes from previously in sales, just thinking of all the things that are communicated or said without being said. But then there's this other layer that is like, can people communicate on a much deeper level without language? Can we communicate telepathically? Can we communicate with animals and trees and all that? And I remember reading the Book of Secrets by Deepak Chopra, and it talks about things that exist in the world that just make you kind of go, holy moly, it's crazy. And how trees, when they're being overforaged, will communicate with other trees miles away to increase the acidity in their leaves so that they don't get eaten as much. And that's so crazy to me. And how a twin, when their twin dies, will feel that pain. You know, the Telepathy Tapes was a podcast series that I listened to about nonverbal autistic children and their ability to communicate telepathically with their mothers and also with each other. And I wanted to get on one of the scientists behind it who was really framing the studies and there and has been studying psychic abilities for so long. And isn't that kind of cool to be able to put a science behind the psychic abilities? Because perhaps you've gotten a hit like, don't go left here, go right. Oh, say no here. And when you don't listen to it, you often have that thought like, man, I knew. I've had that feeling so many times in my life. When we don't listen to the nudge, because, you know, at least in my experience, you're taught not to trust that. You're taught that if it can't be measured, it doesn't exist. And that really, we live in such the age of the intellect, of the brain. And I feel like we're really descending back into our bodies. And if you think about that, that's really the correlation of the nervous system. And I really see the nervous system as a bridge to the soul, to the etheric. And, you know, maybe to be in communication with God, the universe, oneness, whatever you might call it. So with all that said, today's guest is one of the scientists who studied the children in the telepathy tapes and has studied psychic abilities throughout his career. And I'm so excited to have him on. Before we dive in, please, wherever you're listening to this, hit that subscribe button so you don't miss any more episodes. And it's one way to be able to support the show that costs you nothing. And it helps get it in other people's ears. So with all that said, I really hope you enjoy. I hope that it unlocks some or further unlocks telepathic abilities within you, psychic abilities within you, and that you learn to trust yourself and the feelings that you have and that there's value in those. So with all that said, here's Jeff Tarrant. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mark Gross Podcast. Today I'm joined by Dr. Jeff Tarrant. Welcome.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on.
I've been looking forward to this episode because ever since I crushed the telepathy tapes, I was like, all right, I got to get someone who's in the know about what the heck has happened and all the jazz. So I just feel really excited that we get to have this conversation.
Yeah, me too. Let's do it.
So I'm curious for the people listening or watching, what is your background and how did you sort of find yourself in the journey of the telepathy tapes?
Yeah. So my background is actually, I'm a psychologist, and actually my background is in counseling psychology. But very, very early in my career, probably 2 years out, I started getting involved in more neuroscience work and particularly doing neurofeedback as a clinical intervention. And as part of that, we do something called brain mapping, which is basically a quantitative EEG. It allows us to measure people's brainwave activity and then analyze that, compare it to a database or see how things change over time, that sort of thing. And so I've been doing that for 25 years or so. And then, of course, you know, once you start doing that, it's like, well, wait a minute, I can measure all kinds of interesting things.
Yeah.
You know, altered states of consciousness and then eventually moving into more of this realm of looking at psychics and mediums and healers and channelers and things of that nature.
Did you ever think you were going to look in that? Like, was that an origin desire going into the work you were doing originally?
No, I had no idea that that's where this would end up. You know, I was interested in these things as a kid and then kind of gave it up. And actually, I became pretty materialistic and pretty, materialistic from a philosophical consciousness standpoint, and was really a major skeptic for quite a while, you know, until I started practicing things like meditation and qigong and things on my own. and started feeling like, wait a minute, I think maybe there's more going on here. And so some of those early interests that I had kind of were rekindled. And then as the universe often does, things just started landing in my lap. And I just kept going with it. But it certainly was not what I was anticipating.
What was the first moment that you kind of had this, I guess, like reawakening to being connected to something greater than, you might have different words, whatever they are.
Probably it was in Qigong. So I had a background in martial arts and in meditation. And then I kind of like heard about Qigong. At the time I was living in the middle of Missouri. And so it wasn't like there was a lot of Qigong happening.
The Qigong epicenter.
No, not at all. And, you know, but I found this small group that I started practicing with. And I didn't know it at the time, but the instructor was weaving in all kinds of other stuff besides Qigong. So there was some shamanic things going on and a lot of energy healing type practices that I just thought was part of Qigong because I didn't know any different. But so a lot of that practice was, you know, feeling energy and working with energy between people and in groups and with nature. And so, you know, once I started feeling that and experiencing some of these things, for me, that was really the jumping off point of like, oh, wait a minute, this is interesting. You know, I can't explain all of this just by a mechanistic sort of viewpoint. So from then on, I really started becoming more interested in, you know, well, what is possible? And maybe some of those crazy ideas I had as a kid, maybe there's something to it, and then just got right back into it.
How do you start taking the world of measuring and the mapping that you're doing and merge it with that curiosity?
You know, I had started already before I started getting into working with mediums and healers with, you know, things like meditation. And it's like, well, what's going on in the brain? So measuring somebody's brain before they meditate, during their meditation, after the meditation, and what do we see? What happens in the brain? And I started doing that with other things as well, right? And so I started in kind of areas that are more scientifically more acceptable. And then really what happened was I wasn't looking for it, but I was introduced to a woman who reportedly channels South American tribal languages. That's a whole nother story. Well, we can get into it if you want, but I was introduced actually by her son, who was a student of mine when I was at the University of Missouri. And he said, hey, my mom does this interesting thing. Do you want to map her brain? And I was like,
you're like, do I?
Sure. You know, and really, I kind of jokingly say that her name is Janet Mayer. I joke that it's kind of her fault that I'm in this whole world. You know, after working with her on and off for several years, you know, she started introducing me to other mediums and, you know, other people who are in this world. And so then things just, it kind of developed a life of its own. It just kind of took off. And again, I wasn't really looking for it. It just kind of landed there for me. And I just said yes, which, you know, that can be a good thing. Can also get us in trouble.
Good trouble. What did you start to find that was surprising, shocking, exciting?
Yeah. And I mean, starting with Janet, you know, because she developed this ability to just allow these languages to come through her. And this was actually verified years later by an anthropologist who was able to translate the languages and identified four different tribal South American languages that she was speaking. And she doesn't speak any foreign languages. She's never been out of the country. She doesn't even know what she's saying. It's totally crazy. But so having this verified, right, it's like, okay, wait a minute. Somebody verified that this is happening. And then when I measured her brain, what was interesting was, you know, I saw this pattern in the raw EEG signal. So that's like the squiggly lines, where when she was channeling, there would be certain channels that would just, in the EEG, that would just looked crazy. They were just jumping off the screen. And I was like, what the heck is going on here? Like, I thought my system was messed up, or maybe I had a bad connection, or, but it kept happening. You know, I would test her over and over again with different equipment and different EEG caps. And, you know, when I sort of really dove into it, turns out that it was a certain part of her brain in the right parietal lobe, kind of back here, that is involved in boundaries and setting boundaries between self and others. So, you know, the more I started looking at that, it's like, son of a gun. Like, I think what she's doing is somehow she has figured out how to disengage that part of the brain that normally creates barriers. And so she's temporarily able to get that out of the way so that this other information comes through. And so for me, seeing that, and it was like, oh, wow, this all makes sense, right? You know, like whatever you want to believe about it, the pieces all fit together. And it's like, okay, this is intriguing. And, you know, I was fortunate, right, that the first person that I measured had some really interesting and unique brainwave patterns. Because if we would have done it and there wasn't much there, I'd have probably been like, yeah, okay, all right, you know.
It was a good run. It was a good run.
Moving on, you know, but you know, it was so interesting and, you know, and learning. And then that really got me learning about, well, what's going on with this part of the brain? And made me then start to wonder, like, does this happen with other people? For example, like mediums. Because they're kind of doing, even though they're not channeling necessarily, they're still connecting to something, some energy outside of themselves. To me, it kind of made sense of maybe that part of the brain is also involved for them. So, you know, then the questions just, you know, the more, it's like a rabbit hole, right? The more you start with this, the further it goes.
Did you find a correlation to the, I don't know what the right word is, but like the stimulation of that part of the brain? So if I understand you correctly, that part showed more activity when the people were channeling. Is that right?
Sort of. Actually, it almost looked like a seizure back there. You know, it was like really slow brain waves and just at a huge amount of power. Typically, when you see something like that, what that suggests is that part of the brain is not doing its normal job anymore.
Oh, it's like more erratic.
Right. It's almost like it went offline, right? Like that part of the brain went offline. And so that actually fits some of the models, right, of how we understand people's ability to engage in psychic and mediumship work is that the brain is largely inhibiting these abilities. And so it's like you got to get your brain out of the way in order to access these abilities. And so I think that's what she was doing. And that was just the unique way that she had to get the brain out of the way so it wasn't preventing, you know, this kind of access.
How did it compare the activity of someone channeling to someone meditating the same part of the brain?
Yeah, honestly, I've never seen anything like that in relation to meditation. You know, typically with meditation, the one area that's most affected is the default mode network. So it's a network. It's not just one region, but the hub of it is kind of back here. It is in the back of the head, but it's more centralized and it has more to do with identity. So the default mode network is really kind of creating, it's almost like your ego, right? So it's like helping you identify, this is who I am. This is how I see the world. So it is its own set of filters. And, you know, interestingly, there are certain psychics and mediums when they're doing their work that part of the brain shuts off. And so there is some similarity in that regard between certain meditation styles and what we see in the brain, at least with some psychics and mediums.
Wow, that's interesting. When you said that other part of the brain that goes off when people are channeling, that is doing erratic things, you were talking about it being like a place of boundaries. So how does that differentiate from the default mode network?
Yeah. So, and actually, you know, it's possible, depending on how you want to define things, that this part over here, that right parietal lobe, may be part of the default mode network, depending on how you want to slice and dice things, right? Because the default mode network, really, there's the main hub, which is in the center, and then there's these two little wings on the side. And boy, that's getting awfully close to, you know, the area that we saw with Janet. So, and it makes sense, right? That your physical boundaries, I'm Jeff, I live in this little meat suit, you're Mark, you live in your little meat suit, but that's also part of your identity.
Mm-hmm.
Or how you
yeah,
see
it makes sense. Yeah.
Right. It's just a more specialized kind of aspect of that, right? So, you know, there's probably a relationship and a connection. It just doesn't show up the same for everybody, which is kind of interesting.
Is there anything that you have seen over time that were these people like, did they always have it? Was there an activating event?
Yeah, you know, a lot of them talk about having these abilities since they were little. Since they were 4 years old, they were seeing ghosts and talking to their dead relatives and whatever, but not everybody.
You know, there's something sacred about your bed. It's a place where you return after a hard day, where you reflect, where you heal, where you make love, where you cry, where you dream, where you sleep, or where you just breathe. And the truth is, we often overlook how important it is to feel held by the space that we sleep in. That's why I have been continuously obsessed with Cozy Earth. These sheets, I mean, they're not just soft, they're buttery, they're cooling, and sustainably made from bamboo viscose. It's like sliding into a cloud that whispers, hey, you're safe here. And that matters. Because nervous systems that feel safe, they open, they receive, they rest. We can manage emotional experiences in our lives. So sleep isn't just sleep, it's repair. And Cozy Earth gives you the kind of sleep your soul has been craving. Now here's the best part. Cozy Earth is offering my listeners up to 40% off. That's right, 40% off. Because deep rest shouldn't be a luxury. It should be a lifestyle. So if you're ready to transform your relationship with rest, go to cozyearth.com and use the code MARK at checkout. You will feel the difference that these sheets make. That is for certain. And remember, you are allowed to feel that good.
Now, so, you know, back to Janet. She is interesting because she did have some psychic and mediumship, well, she still does, abilities starting when she was a kid. But then what activated the channeling was actually going to a holotropic breathwork session with her sister. For people that aren't maybe knowledgeable, it's a rapid breathing technique with evocative music that can essentially induce a psychedelic state. So she was doing this with her sister, and that's what activated these languages. She sat up in the middle of her session, and this stuff just started coming out of her.
My God, that'd be crazy if you're her sister. You're like, I was in a ceremony once, it was ayahuasca, and a woman started speaking in like alien languages.
Yeah.
It was wild. Yeah.
Right. And so apparently, you know, there are certain altered states, certain individuals that, you know, this can kind of unlock some of that ability, you know, and for her, it's just very specific. It's just this very specific tribal, you know, who knows where it's coming from in terms of, is it out there in the ether or is she picking up something that's happening live? You know, is it like a radio broadcast and she's tuning into something that's happening? You know, like I have no idea and she doesn't know. But yeah, so it's interesting because there are people that have some sort of an incident, you know, and even when you look at the research literature, you'll see that there's an inordinate number of mediums who report having had like a traumatic brain injury or something like that. And so it does seem like that if you nudge the brain out of its normal functioning, however that happens, that at least for some people, that can really activate some of these abilities.
Do you think that's what's happening with the telepathy tapes, you know, with the autistic, the nonverbals, is that there is the brain's not in the way in some capacity with language, with all the things that are taking up? You know, it's like when someone is deaf, they have hyper-attuned other senses. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what do you think is at the origins of it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we're still trying to figure that out. I've got a little bit of brain mapping data from some of the non-speaking autistic individuals, you know, featured in the telepathy tapes, but I need a lot more data, right? But what's interesting is that all of these individuals that are being studied in the telepathy tapes are, they don't communicate verbally. And so at least one of the ideas is that maybe that's part of what allows this capability for them. For me, it makes sense in two different ways. You know, in one way, if you think about the function of language, you know, it's really to create a structure around our experience so that we can share it. And every time we do that, every time we use language, we've actually limited our experience. We've taken whatever happened and we said, oh, it's this.
Yeah, so true.
You know, we put it in a little category. And then that actually changes what the nature of what it is. It's not that thing, but that's how we describe it. And that's a very left-brained way of behaving, which is where most language functions occur. And so the other thing that's interesting is even with other mediums and psychics who are neurotypical, you see way more changes in the right hemisphere when they're doing their thing. And so what I suspect is that a lot of these non-speakers, they are just much more in that present moment awareness of what's happening. They don't have language to get in the way of their experience. I mean, one way that somebody was talking about it that I think makes sense is that maybe telepathy is actually a more primary way of communicating. And we've kind of limited ourselves by creating a language structure, that that's how we communicate. You know, that's how we interact, is like we're doing now. We're using words. But maybe there's a more primary way of communicating that we've kind of lost. We've kind of lost access to, you know, because we've become overly dependent on words.
It is fascinating to think that we are using parts of our brains to actually, there's maybe too much noise or too much information coming in if we were open to telepathy, you know? So it's almost like how the unconscious mind can process so many more bits and bytes, but yet we don't even, it's doing all that without us even thinking about it. I wonder if it's also, you know, what we might call a gut instinct, you know, that we're actually like picking up on these many more. You know, in the research, they would say, oh, well, people who are, let's say, hypervigilant or more anxiously attached have a greater, they can sense micromotor movements. And is it because of their hypervigilance? Or is it? And I started to think about this after I listened to the telepathy tapes. I was like, I wonder if people with attachment disorders, which disorder not being bad, but, you know, some form, different types,
sure,
that they actually still have access to their telepathy on some level, and it was due from a state of survival.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And I mean, and again, you know, we were talking before about that you see, you know, more people with traumatic brain injuries and things like that. You know, not only that, but you'll also see that people sometimes after some sort of emotional or psychological trauma, that will also unlock some of these abilities for people, or they tend to be more intuitively tapped in. And so, you know, maybe there's something to that, right? That it is a more basic kind of way of understanding things, and different life experiences or injuries or whatever makes it more accessible for certain people. I don't know. We have a lot to figure out. That's for sure.
Yeah. How did you end up getting involved in the telepathy tapes?
Yeah, I actually had known the primary researcher, Diane Powell, for many years. Actually, the very first research I did with Janet, I presented at a conference. You know, Janet was like, hey, there's this mediumship conference. Let's go present our stuff. And I was like, okay, sure, whatever. And Diane was there. She was also speaking. And so I met her, you know, 12 or 13 years ago now. And we had stayed in touch periodically. When she started working with Kai Dickens on the telepathy tapes, which, you know, it was originally supposed to be a documentary. It was never supposed to be a podcast. You know, Diane had called me up and said, hey, would you be interested in doing some brain mapping on some of these kids for this project? Kind of like with Janet, you know, I'm like, yeah, you know, that sounds great. You know, sign me up. And then I met Kai, and Kai is amazing, just really great. And we hit it off really well. I got sort of pulled in to the beginning aspects of a lot of the project. Now, it's kind of taken off in lots of other directions since, you know, I first got involved. So, you know, we'll see where it all goes, because I think where we started is not necessarily where things ended up.
Yeah, starting with a documentary, then at one point, the world's number one podcast, which is wild. My friend listened to it a couple months before it kind of picked up its acclaim and sent it to me. And it took me about a month and a half to start listening to it. And I listened to all 10 episodes in one drive because I had a long road trip. And I know there's new episodes out. So I just saw a notification for them. I'm like, damn, I've been missing episodes. Like, I've been waiting to get deeper into this. I sent it to, and I'm going to, the reason I'm going to share this is because I want to understand how through your career, you've navigated skeptics and the more material view of the world. I sent it to someone really close to me who really loves language. And I said, I thought you would find this really fascinating. Academic, former professor. And I got a reply back. I said, have you listened to this? They said, oh, thanks for sending this. Great. And then they Googled it and then said to me, I said, oh, have you listened to it yet? It was so good. And they said to me, no, you know, it's like a little out of my realm and I'm more of a rigid thinker and it's not, you know, whatever. And I said, well, you could easily say I'm a flexible thinker, and now you'd listen to it. So your identity is kind of creating a trap. Just say you don't want to listen to it and we could be done.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I formerly was in pharma. My dad's a researcher. So I like understand the more material view of science. I left pharma well over a decade ago and dove into relationship stuff, which then led to the understanding of emotionality and then how that impacts inflammation. And then, you know, I said to my wife when I listened to the telepathy tapes, I sent it to her. We have a son who's two. And I said, I think I know your answer to this, but do you think mothers and children all have telepathy? She's like, duh. So how did you handle when you started to move out of the space of, let's say, traditional psychological research and practice to this? And is what I heard a common thing you've heard?
Yeah. And, you know, and I still do some more traditional-ish research. You know, this is kind of like a part of what I do now, right? You know, but it's interesting because I tend to just be kind of a go with the flow kind of a guy, right? Like I didn't really think about it too much before I got in. I was just kind of like, oh, it's fine. I'm just going to do this thing. Like, who cares? Right. You know, and it was interesting because initially I didn't see any negative comments or pushback from anybody, but I wasn't super vocal about it initially. Right. And it was interesting because when I started working on my book and started talking more about some of these things, one of the first things that happened, it might have been right when my book came out, a group that I'd been working with, not in this field at all, you know, more with neuromeditation kinds of things and related to psychedelic integration therapies and things like that. And they basically fired me and through an email.
That's not even good breakup technique.
No. And essentially what they said was, since I'm no longer interested in science, that they felt like this wasn't a good match anymore. And I was like, huh, okay, interesting. And so, and I had a couple of other people who were in my network kind of reach out to me in a nicer way and say, hey, this is a little out there. you know, you're likely to turn some people off by talking about these things. And I was like, huh, like to me, that was a big shock, right? Because I was like, who cares? Like, shouldn't we be curious? And, you know, like the world's a very big and complicated place. And so really, it was with the telepathy tapes where started seeing much more pushback, right? And a lot of skeptics coming out and slamming aspects of it. I've still managed to keep myself personally out of a lot of that just because, you know, I had a more minor role in the telepathy tape.
So, not anymore, Jeff. Not anymore.
honestly, to me, it doesn't bother me too much because I think it's important to be skeptical, like in the true sense of that word.
Yeah.
That, you know, yeah, we shouldn't just believe things because somebody says it or, you know, because you read it somewhere, especially in this day and age, right? Anything can be faked and sensationalized, and I get it. And so I think it's wise to be skeptical, you know, again, in the true sense of that word. You know, I think it's also important that it's like, well, if there is some compelling evidence for something, even if we don't understand it and it doesn't make any sense, well, scientifically, shouldn't we be exploring that? Shouldn't we try to understand,
right,
you know, what's going on here? You know, and if it turns out, if somebody did a big research, this won't happen because I've seen this. I know it's real, but if somebody did a big study and figured out this was all a bunch of junk, okay, great.
Right.
That's good information. But shouldn't we be looking at it? Like, why would we just write it off and say, this isn't possible, so we're not going to look at it? And it's like, well, to me, that's not scientific. That's anti-science.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said about that specific aspect, which, you know, it's like when people bring that type of shaming or, you know, the projection of their own fears for you, like, well, this might not be that well received, or have you thought about? I mean, I get that shit all the time. But you realize, like, if we continue to curb our own curiosities, like, oh, I guess I can't look into telepathy because my aunt said it might be something that people will judge me for, which is really the fear of being associated with me and being judged. It's like, then I guess I can't look at it. And it's like, imagine, then everyone else's limitations become our own and we stay in the same narrow box. But, you know, you guys drew a really interesting parallel in the podcast. And I got to say, I I'm like a healthy skeptic of that stuff, but I'm very interested in that stuff because I've experienced things that are wild. So, and I know people who have experienced things that are wild. And I just think like, well, maybe there is more to it. Like we can't, like we call an aspect of DNA that we don't understand junk DNA, but like, you know, even I had an argument with someone recently about just the genetic predeterminants for cancer versus epigenetic impacts on these determinants. And they were like, there's no epigenetic impact. I'm like, I could literally show you studies that exercise turns on and off genes. Like this isn't, I'm not saying anything radical, but to a traditionalist, it is. When I look at this conversation, I kind of go early on in the telepathy tapes, this is why I thought it'd be good for my friend who said, hell no, because the cognitive dissonance is titrated very slowly in the episodes. So even for someone who is, I think the title might throw some people off.
Yeah.
But the dissonance is, it's like a slow exposure therapy. You know, you like put your toe in the cold and you move up. And what I found to be really powerful is the segue or the comparison that you guys do to savants, that science just accepts that savants exist. But for some reason, telepathy is like, no, but like, I remember watching, you know, when you run out of shit to watch on a plane and then you end up watching shit you'd never watch. I ended up watching some sort of show, but it was about someone who had a brain injury and then could play the piano like a professional. And I remember being on this flight being like, this is crazy. So you guys talk about that. This, I forget what it's called, but can you explain like how science perceives savants versus telepathy?
Yeah, I mean, it is, and you know, and I'm not an expert on, you know, savant syndrome, and you know, kind of what you were describing was, you know, they call it acquired savant syndrome. So, because a lot of, you know, typically it's something that if you see somebody with a savant ability, they are somebody that has some sort of neurodevelopmental delay or of some kind. Usually, they've got an autism diagnosis. You know, which is interesting, right? Because that's the population that we're kind of looking at here. And of course, you know, savants, they've got these abilities to do amazing things, usually in music or math or languages or, you know, artistic things that with no training, you know, there's this high level.
It's crazy.
Complex ability, right? But there are these weird instances of people where they've had a head injury and then all of a sudden they develop some sort of savant ability.
Like language. You guys talk about the guy who repeats, I think it's 28,000 digits of pi.
Right.
And he said it's like a ticker tape just going through his head with, I think he said colors, a color represents, I forget.
Yeah. I don't remember exactly, but yeah, something like that. And that's another common thing, right, is this sort of synesthesia aspect that a lot of times people will, their senses will become mixed in some sort of way. So, you know, they may, so, you know, their brain may connect a color with a number or something. And so then they've got these interesting ways of perceiving the world that are very different than non-savants or non-synesthetes would see things.
The summer nights are heating up. And if you've been waking up drenched or tossing around trying to find the new cool spot on your bed, I totally get it. I've been there. And let's be honest, if your mattress is trapping heat, it might be time for a change. That's why I want to tell you about a product I really believe in, Avocado Green Mattress. These mattresses are next level, luxuriously comfortable, naturally breathable, and made with certified organic materials. And if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you know I'm all about high quality organic products that support not just our health, but also the planet. Avocado uses certified organic latex, wool, and cotton. So you're not sleeping on chemicals. You're sleeping on materials that are better for your body and designed to breathe, which means cooler sleep, especially when it's hot outside. Whether you love a firmer feel or want something plush, Avocado's got options for everybody and every sleep style. They even have a mattress quiz to help you find your perfect match, which I love because sleep is deeply personal and one size does not fit all. Now, here's the thing I respect most about Avocado. They walk their talk. They're a certified B Corp, which means they meet the highest standards in sustainability, ethics, and transparency.
Every decision from farm to finished product is rooted in care for you and for the planet. This isn't just about selling mattresses. It's about supporting a healthier life, a healthier earth. And that's a mission I can definitely get behind. And the logistics, easy. You can get financing with Affirm, a sleep trial for up to a full year, and retail locations if you want to try one in person. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com and save up to 20% on certified organic mattresses during their Labor Day sale. Avocado, dream of better.
And so, yeah, it is interesting. It's because, right? Because people don't, nobody argues and says that Savant syndrome doesn't exist. Like, nobody says that. It's kind of like, we all right. just
accept it. It's just known. They saw Rain Man and they're like, it happens.
Yeah, it's a thing, right? But we don't really understand, like, how is that possible? And I really like that that's kind of the direction that some of the conversation went in the telepathy tapes, because I think it really is a really great parallel. Because it's like, well, okay, wait a minute. If we accept that certain humans can do things that they shouldn't be able to do, and they've got some sort of knowledge or ability that they did not acquire through any sort of normal way, well, how is this different? Like, it's kind of the same thing. And so, you know, that's one of the arguments, right, that gets made is like, well, maybe, you know, and Dr. Paul talks about this, maybe telepathy should be considered a savant ability. Yeah, it makes perfect sense, right? It's like, well, okay, they've got this interesting ability at a very high level that they didn't train for, they didn't try for it. It just exists. And even though we could argue that maybe we're all telepathic, so, right, like your wife and your son, right? Like, okay, but they're not able to do, I'm guessing, the same things that some of these kids can do, right? Like,
no, I haven't tested her, but some of that stuff, yeah, explain what some of these kids are doing. I'll test her after the episode and then get back to you.
Yeah, do it. Actually, you know what? If you really want to test her, I've got a remote computer system that we could do some tests. But
I'll see if she's down for it. You know what? My son wouldn't be able to do it yet because he's only two.
Oh, yeah.
But
we'll wait till he gets older.
We'll wait till he gets older and then we'll do a podcast on my wife's telepathy.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. So, yeah. I mean, what's interesting about a lot of the kids that have been studied is that it does seem to be predominantly with their primary caregiver, which is usually the mother, not always, but typically.
Almost always. Yeah.
Almost always. That seems to be where the strongest connection is. For some of them, that's the only person that they can read that way. That's not true for all of them, but for some of them, it's only their mom that they can read. So it does suggest that maybe, at least again, for some of them, that there's something about that connection, that bond opens up something, you know, a different way of understanding each other or communicating. But yeah, they, you know, they can see and perceive anything that their mom is connected to. And so there's a family that I'm getting ready to go study in a couple of weeks. And so we've been talking on the phone and sharing emails, and she's been playing little games where she'll sing a song in her head and then ask her son to spell out, what song am I singing? And he'll spell out the song, and then she'll say, what band is it? And he'll spell out the band, and she'll say, who's the lead singer? And he'll spell out the lead singer. It's crazy. Like, it almost doesn't matter what the information is. In fact, one of the people that was featured on the telepathy tapes, John Paul, who he passed away a year and a half ago or so, you know, he would communicate with his mom, you know, by spelling and tell her that she needed to, like, quiet down her internal state because it was, like, distracting. Like, it was like, you know, it was like so much additional information that it's like you need to, like, quiet yourself down because, you know, I can't focus. <You know? laughs> So some of them talk about it is that it's like more like sharing consciousness.
Yes. Yeah. Like they're one, they together have a channel open.
Yeah.
But yeah, could the mother pick up with the son? It wasn't two way, was it?
No, I mean, some people do talk about that. Certain teachers and a few parents do talk about having the ability to pick up information from them. But in most instances, it seems to be sort of one way.
That's really interesting. I, as you said, I think it's like this hyper attunement that you just overdeveloped, because maybe it's as you had said, a primary way of communicating that we've since left, you know, and met the limitations of language.
Yeah, for sure. But what they can do is just, it's incredible, right? Because it's just, and there's no good way from a materialistic standpoint to make any sense out of it. Like, how is it possible, right? Because, you know, like what a lot of the skeptics will bring up is, it's like, well, maybe there's some subtle cueing happening, right? From,
isn't it all filmed?
It is all filmed.
How do you subtle cue 5 digits?
Exactly.
Just right? So for context, maybe explain one of the experiments and then what the critics say.
Yeah. So, you know, a typical experiment would be showing the mother, right? Because again, we'll say typical, right? So
yeah,
they have the best connection with their mother. So we would show the mother either a random digit, like a 4-digit number or something, or a random word or some variation of that theme, right?
It could be on like an iPad or something.
Yeah, yeah. You use an iPad that's got like a random word generator or a random number generator app. You know, we're not choosing the numbers or the words. It's the computer is generating it from whatever bank it has.
And it's all filmed.
It's all filmed.
Yeah.
You know, everything in the room that's got a reflective surface is taken down or moved out of the room. So there's no way.
So it's controlled. Like for the materialists, you're doing as much as you can.
Doing as much as we can. Right. And so, you know, you show the mom whatever it is a word or a number. And then like if it's on an iPad, show it to her. It's like, you got it. Okay. Close it. So like that's not even available now. Right. That's gone. And then it's like going to the receiver. So going to the non-speaker, they typically communicate by pointing to a letter board or a number board. So it's basically like a size of a piece of paper. And some of them are kind of like a stencil. So it's got all the letters of the alphabet kind of in stencil form. And they would either point to the letters to spell or numbers, or like a lot of times they'll also use like a pencil to like stick it through the stencil, right? So it's really clear which thing they're pointing to. So yeah, you know, you've shown the mom the thing, you hold the board for the kid, and they just, it's like 100%. They don't miss.
That's what's crazy. Know? It's like you guys kept testing it over and over again because you're like, how? And then it's just so many. Is it enough times, which I can't imagine more than 4 or 5 would create statistical significance, probably 2. But is it enough times that you've like massively surpassed statistical significance?
Oh,
well,
100%
is way past statistical significance.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's especially when you think about
it. Crazy.
It's totally crazy. And if you think about it this way, yeah, like I don't think anybody's calculated statistical significance yet. That's we're working on another project and we're going to be doing some of that. But, you know, if you think about it, like traditionally, the telepathy tests that were done in the 60s and well, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s with, you know, sort of average neurotypical people, grab them off the street, stick one person in one room and one person in another room using Zener cards or something like that. They're all forced choice tests, right? Here's 5 different types of cards. Okay, you look at one of the cards, send that image telepathically to this other person. They've got a 1 in 5 chance of guessing correctly.
Yeah.
Right? So they've got a 20% chance of getting it right. And so after looking at decades of that research, the results are kind of like the average is somewhere like around 30% or maybe 35%, which is statistically significant.
Which is better than 20, yeah.
It's better than 20. But it's nowhere near 100.
Yeah.
And so what's interesting about these kids is not only are they getting 100%, but they're getting it with an open response format. So if you say, okay, this is a word.
Right.
Okay. Right. Like, well, how many words are there? Right. Again, you know, like we were doing one test on a computer and we were doing 3-syllable words. And so like one of the words was manager. Right. So like statistically, what is the likelihood that somebody is just going to guess manager?
It's like, right? So it's so remote, it's not even statistically, it's probably statistically 0 almost,
right? It would be almost 0. And so, you know, and so, and then think about doing, you know, 10 or 20 of those in a row, right? Like statistically it's ridiculous. Like it would be, it's off the chart, right? It doesn't,
how's there, you know, still a skeptic? I don't understand.
So I mean, the skeptic arguments really seem to mostly focus on cueing. And in 2 different ways. So because there's a lot of conversation in the telepathy tapes about facilitated communication.
Yeah, the like where the mom is touching. I think it progresses, right? When they first start doing it, they touch like their hand.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And then they move up. And for some of them, they just like literally touch their shoulder, right? Something like that.
Right. Yeah. And like the very first kid that I observed, the mom just put one finger on her forehead. And that was all it took. They had moved
on her forehead?
On the child's forehead.
On the forehead. And somehow that's cueing?
That was enough. Well, right. So this is the thing, right? So some people are going like, well, but you're still making physical contact. Like maybe there's a way that you could, and it's like, how?
Like you're really reaching though, when you're calling that the criticism of the trial. I would just like that person. Is that critic? Cause I just kind of like probably know this type of person. Is that critic willing to sit in the room while it happens?
I don't know. It's a good question because I've not interacted with any of these folks. They just write things, you know, like there's lots of blogs and YouTube things.
Well, they're picking up on the hype of the telepathy tapes. And of course, you know what? I wouldn't be surprised if the person I sent it to wrote a blog about it. You know, they didn't. But I'm just laughing because they're the type of person who Googled it and then saw a criticism of it. And then we're like, no, it was fact checked by Reuters. So I guess it's not.
Yeah. Right. And so the thing is that the vast majority, maybe all of the kids that were looked at, they weren't using facilitated communication. It wasn't, nobody was. So
they weren't even being touched.
They weren't being touched at all. So, you know, the person that I talked about was the very first person I witnessed. Everybody else, there's no touch at all. So that argument actually doesn't even make any sense because, you know, 90% of the kids, there's zero touch. There's none. So the other place where the critics come in, and this is actually not a, it's not a terrible argument, but it's like, because also the mom is also the one holding the letterboard. And sometimes if you're looking at the video, you can see the mom making little movements and things. And
so she's watching where the child, if you put a blindfold on her, wouldn't that resolve that?
That is a good idea. I like that. And it's tricky because some of these kids, they even need their mom or whoever their communication partner is with the telepathy to be the one holding the board, which who knows why that is. But actually, I may take your idea and borrow it for this next set of tests that we're doing, because this is one of those kids that he really needs his mom to be the one holding the board. But even then, right, like even if the mom's holding the board, even if there's tiny movements, and most of the time there's not any discernible movement, but sometimes there is. But even then, if you think about it, you know, like you've got the entire alphabet on this board. Yeah, and it's like, and the movements are like subtle. It's not like they're going like, oh, you know.
Yeah, like hit the cue, hit the cue, hit the cue. Yeah.
Exactly. Right. And so it's like, even if you think about that, that it's like, okay, they've got a pencil and they're coming at the board. You would have to do some significant maneuvering of that letterboard to show them exactly where you wanted them to go. Again, I get it. It's not ideal at all in terms of sort of a, you know, a scientific method that you've got somebody holding the board that knows what the word is.
You could do a few cool things though, because you could take, I don't know if this is possible because I've not interacted with a board and a nonverbal autistic kid, but I'm wondering if you actually didn't tell the mother and there was like a random generated board that just had different orders of letters. And so she can't see what the board is like. And so when she holds it up, she can't, none of this would correlate. But I don't know if the kid would then get dysregulated because the board is different. But if you covered the back, like where there was no ability to see, does the child generally need to be in sort of eye contact with the mother or no?
Not necessarily. I mean, usually they're not really looking at the mom most of the time. I mean, if you think about it this way too, right? Most of them, I don't want to say all, because there's always going to be exceptions, but most of them have a lot of difficulty managing their body.
Yeah. So
just getting the pencil through a letter like requires some effort, right? And so it's like, you know, you can kind of tell that there's some focus going on, right? So they're not really looking at the mom necessarily. You know, they're focused on what they're trying to accomplish here. I love your idea of the blindfold. I think that's a great idea. We've also developed kind of a computer-based one where it's a touch screen, you know, that mimics the letterboard. And so, you know, trying to see if we can use that is something that would work instead of a letterboard, so that they can just hit the numbers on the computer directly, or the words, spell it out, But, you know, back to the skeptical thing. So even though that's a criticism and a valid criticism, there's actually a number of kids that don't even require that, right? That we tested where the kid was typing independently in the other room, or one of them that I was involved in. I wasn't involved in that one, but one that I was, even though he was using a letterboard, he didn't need his mom to hold it. So somebody else was holding it that had no idea what the word was.
Okay, so there's been controls that disprove that criticism.
Yeah.
Also, you wouldn't get 100% accuracy. If that was the way you were doing it, you'd punch the wrong hole for sure if it was from this like slight movement. You know what I mean?
Right. That's what I mean. So I get it. I get some of the criticisms, but I feel like they're a little bit overblown for what we're seeing. You know, it's kind of like, you know, and even if you were to say, which, you know, any of us who are involved in wanting to do more research, it's like we're trying to control for those things as much as we can, right? Because it's like, well, yeah, that's a valid criticism. Okay, we need to control for that. But again, that doesn't mean that it's not happening, right? It's like if you observe it, it's like something interesting is going on here. Yes, we need to control some things, and there's some situations that could be improved. You know, but how many testing conditions are perfect? And again, you know, like when you do this with 5 kids, 10 kids, 20 kids, it's like, okay, this isn't just one instance.
Right.
I think there's a lot of case study material that is very, very clear. And so we just have to follow it and you know, do a better job, right, of getting really, really clean data so that even the skeptics, the ones who are open-minded, will have to look at it and go like, huh, okay, this is interesting. You know, there's going to be other skeptics that no matter what we do, they're not going to buy it. You know, it won't matter. It won't matter what we come up with.
Well, I think the idea of it can be really terrifying to people. You know, the idea, which is, it's interesting that some people just desperately don't want it to be true and will never, as you said, no matter the amount of data, which is true of like really rigid identities and biases of anything, you know. And I think if it's like when I used to work in pharma, you'd work with someone who was a key opinion leader whose research created the success of a product, for example. Like, I remember when I first started, I was selling a statin. There were like new statins coming out, and there were the original statins. And one of the researchers of the original statin was in the area that I worked in the district, in the region. And that guy, it didn't matter what data came out that was showing better or different. And even now, I mean, the conversation about statins is very different than 15 years. Well, that'd be 23 years ago. So very different.
Yeah.
He's still not changed his mind for sure. But it's like so interesting when their identities are so tied to these things that it can't be. And that could be both ways, of course.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you guys are really open to the skepticism because your desire is to actually get the most rigid answer, not the answer being what you desire. But man, it's hard to, because I went and watched some of the stuff that you guys put online too. And I was like, this is, and the kids communicating with each other separately is wild, which when you guys started talking about the hill, I was like, what? What's happening here?
Yeah, that's what I mean. You know, when I was talking earlier that I think the direction of the storyline changed, right? As, you know, wherever we started, nobody was aware of the hill initially, right? And so then once you start talking to more families and kids and going like, oh, wait a minute. So obviously that was a thread that Kai had to follow. This, you know, this story about the hill, and then, you know, all of these other abilities that some of them have of talking to deceased relatives and whatever. It's like, okay, like, you know, clearly there's a can of worms here that there's just a lot more going on than just telepathy, right?
And for context, can you explain what the hill is for people?
Yeah. So the hill is sort of a psychic chat room, I guess, where a lot of these non-speakers reportedly go to hang out and talk to each other and teach each other and share information. And, you know, I think what's interesting about it is that, you know, Kai has interviewed enough people now that she keeps hearing this brought up and used the same way from people that don't know each other from all over the world. And so it's kind of like, okay, you know, if you hear from one or two people and they know each other, it's like, okay, you know, maybe whatever. But then for other kids to be bringing this up and saying like, oh yeah, this is what we do and we call it the Hill. And it's like, okay, wait a minute. Like, how are they all using the same term and describing it the exact same way? It sounds like something's going on, right? And so, yeah, that's a little bit of a trickier one to test, right? You know, like, how do you test that? I mean, there's ways, but it does get trickier.
Yeah, that one's definitely, so this intercommunication between nonverbals, were there any tests done with verbal autistic kids?
Not that I'm aware of. You know, some of them are unreliable speakers. So, you know, sometimes they can say some things, you know, but they're not very consistent. But I don't think, I could be wrong, because I haven't been involved in every aspect of all of this. So it's possible, but I'm not aware of any. Actually, one of the things I'm interested in looking at is, you know, I've been following a couple of groups that have formed, like on Facebook and whatever, of parents and teachers who are kind of involved in this world. And there's a number of parents and teachers who claim to have their own telepathic abilities. Okay, I'd be interested to study that, you know, and it's like, what's going on here? So, you know, yeah, I mean, I think there's so much, you know, to look at. You know, this may keep me busy the rest of my life.
What do you think, or what are you most excited about in the research and the work to come and what you want to, and maybe what you're starting to understand?
It's interesting because from a personal perspective, I don't need to be convinced. Like, I'm already convinced that this is happening, but I do feel like it's important to get it out there. So I do want to contribute to the research in that way to help move this conversation into a space that is even more accepted, and that, you know, we start to kind of look at some of these kids and their abilities and take it seriously and take them seriously. You know, that's an area that I really appreciate that Kai picked up, was this whole idea of presuming competence with these individuals. You know, because they have difficulty controlling their bodies, we often look at them and think there's nobody there, or there's nobody home, or they're not smart. You know, and schools will teach them their colors their entire academic career, thinking they don't understand anything. And then once they start communicating by spelling, you start finding out like, oh, whoa, they know a ton of information and they're wise and they're creative. And so getting people to understand that, right? Because that was actually something I had to learn for myself in this process. I mean, I'm not proud of it, but I largely had the same idea that most everybody else does. It was like, oh, okay, you know, they're not really there.
Yeah, I did too, for sure.
You know, and so for me, it's really changed the way I've thought about a lot of people, right? That it's like, you know, what if we just presumed competence, you know, in everybody, regardless of what we see with our eyes. So anyway, I went slightly off tangent, but I think it's important, right? That we have a more open mind to the abilities of other people just because they're not neurotypical, you know, and they don't sort of look and act the way we think that they should, whatever that is. But so beyond sort of like proving this, you know, my interests are in kind of looking at the brain, obviously, right? That's kind of my main part of all of this, you know, trying to understand, is there something different happening in their brains when they're doing this telepathic work that is either similar or different to what I've seen with other mediums and psychics? Maybe it's the same process, but theirs is just enhanced somehow. So I'm very curious about that and want to get some more good data looking at the brains. And then probably my favorite area of interest at the moment is seeing if we can take the data that we have and reverse engineer it. If we know, for instance, going back to Janet from the beginning of the conversation, that this right parietal lobe seems to be important. By the way, I saw some interesting activity there with two of the three non-speakers that we tested. You know, so are there ways that we can use technology or neurostimulation to encourage other people's brains into a more receptive pattern? So people that want to develop these abilities for themselves, can we kind of take what we're learning and expand that so that people can start to unlock their own brains?
Have you ever looked to see if there's an overlap between the use of psilocybin and the right parietal lobe?
I haven't seen anything specifically with that question. There is a guy, I'm going to block on his name. There's a researcher who has looked at the relationship between psychic abilities and psychedelic use.
Yeah.
And he's published quite a few things and seems to be a pretty strong connection between those two. And not even just during a psychedelic state, because obviously during a psychedelic state, you know, it's not uncommon at all for people to be engaged in some sort of spirit communication or telepathy or whatever. But even outside of those sessions, it seems like there's a higher percentage of people that report having that, those experiences. So I think there's something there, right? Because you're kind of creating more entropy in the brain. You know, you're loosening those structures, which is, I think, what needs to happen, right? For most of us.
Yeah, it's interesting too, when you look at the data on flow states, because in flow states, people, their identity, they're at one with the music, and they're part of their brain that's in charge of the self shuts down. So now they're not going through this lens, this filter that says, who am I to the world? How do I be that in every moment? Which really doesn't allow you to be in the present moment. And so I think about how it seems like every mystical teaching, every spiritual teaching is about getting that self out of the way. And, you know, recently I was thinking a lot about how the nervous system, if I was to assume the nervous system is somehow the connection between this world and consciousness, that when you're in a meditative state and regulated, people feel more connected at one with the whatever. But I'm like, then there must be wisdom to sympathetic activation. And it's like, oh, I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, oh yeah, because the sympathetic activation is what gets you to a place where you can then shut down the self and like go into a meditative state. But if I don't flight or I don't, you know, fawn, then I'm not going to be able to get myself to a safe place where I can then communicate with greater. Yeah, it's kind of, and I was thinking about that being like gut instinct, you know what I mean? It's like that greater consciousness, take a left here, that leads you to a place where you can be connected with whatever people will call it, God consciousness.
I mean, certainly I think there's a lot of, I mean, we have a lot of data to suggest that, you know, that you're exactly right. You know, that whether it's through meditation practices or whatever, that, you know, somehow getting the brain out of the way, at least in terms of the ego structure, right? Which of course takes up a lot of space, takes up a lot of real estate.
Yeah.
You know, us thinking about ourselves, that's what we do best.
We are good at that.
We're really good at it. You know, and so, and it also makes sense, right? Like every medium I've talked to, when you ask them, well, what can other people do? They say meditation. That's like the very first thing they say. And I think it is, it's a process of learning to disconnect. Can you take your identity out of the equation? You know, they'll also even say too, right? Like if you're doing a reading, like just say everything that comes through, don't edit it. Don't think about it. Don't analyze it. Don't, because as soon as you do that, now you're back in your left brain and you're creating a story about it. And so don't do that. Just like whatever comes through, even if it sounds crazy, just say it. It's like unfiltered, right? Mm-hmm. You're being unfiltered. And so, you know, I think for most of us, that's a really hard thing to learn how to do. You know, we spend a lot of time filtering.
Yeah, we do. So much filtering. And then you don't create, I mean, then relationally, you're not person to person, you're mask to mask, you know, and Right. And then of course you're not in the present moment. And then I always think like time goes real slow when you're present. Time goes real slow when you're you. Thank you so much for your time. I could talk about this stuff all day. Yeah. I think it's so incredible and I love what you're up to. And I'm so grateful that you took the time to be able to share with us all the things you're learning and clearly excited about, which is so great. For the people listening, where can they find more of you, more of your work, more of your, all the things?
Yeah, there's really two places. I've got two websites, which is the easiest way to find me and whatever I'm up to. The first one is the Neuro Meditation Institute. And that's more meditation, technology, whatever. And that's www.neuromeditationinstitute.com.
Right.
The other one, and this is what happened when people were giving me trouble. I had to make a branch. So the other branch is the Psychic Mind Science. So www.psychicmindscience.com. And that's more of the weird stuff. So the stuff we've been talking about largely and some of the research and work that we're doing there.
Good weird. Good weird.
Good weird. Good. Oh, yeah. For sure.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay, well, we'll put all the links in the show notes, everybody. And Jeff, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.